This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. Today is one of those episodes. Sometimes we hit on a topic I really don't know anything about at all, so I am going to learn a lot, and I bet we are going to have listeners that are fascinated at today's guest.
I agree. This is such an amazing question. So what problem are we solving today?
How do you make software?
How do you make software? You know, I have always wondered that. But who is our guest who's going to explain it all to us, Jeff?
Our guest today is the terrific Rich Sheridan. He is, listen to his title, CEO and Chief Storyteller at Menlo Innovations.
Welcome to the show, Rich.
Great to be here, Jeff and Jennifer. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, we are so excited because we're going to be talking about computers again and softwares, because some of our listeners have already heard us talk about code breaking, which is really intriguing. But now we're kind of going to the other side. So can you start and tell us a little bit about what you do at Menlo Innovations?
So, Jennifer, what we do for a living is we design and develop software. Oh. Runs on computers or phones or iPads or Android devices, or we help people create websites. There has to be a magical set of people behind the scenes that make all those things work. We just happen to be some of those people behind the scenes.
Okay. And is there a limit to what you write software for? Only certain types of programs, or are you wide open depending on what your customer needs?
Jeff, we're pretty wide open here. We love the variety. For us, the excitement
right. Okay.
Our environment is just not doing the same thing over and over again, but learning about new technologies, because, you know, everybody knows technology is changing all the time.
Oh, yes.
There's a new device coming out. There's a new technology coming out. Our team gets excited about that. They want to learn about it. They want to experiment with it. They want to give it a try.
Yeah, that sounds fun. So can you give us kind of like a step-by-step? So this company or whatever might come to you and say, hey, I need this new website or this new program. Like, what do you do from there?
Yeah, a lot of times people will come in and they'll say, hey, I hear you guys build software. We want to build a new app for an iPhone.
there you go.
Right. And so our first question to them, which kind of stumps them a little bit at first, is they say, great. Well, what problem are you trying to solve?
Imagine that.
And they look at us funny. They're like, well, the problem is we need an app built, and that's why we're here. And I tell them,
they try to put it back on you, right?
No, an app might be a solution to the problem you're trying to solve, but I can assure you, not any one of your listeners ever woke up in the morning saying to themselves, you know what I need more than anything else today? I need a new app. Nobody ever said that. And so we can use technology to solve problems, and we've seen many of those over the course of human history, right? That we started
using
technology to solve problems. But we need to back up. We need to understand, what do they see wrong in the world, and where do they believe a new piece of software could help? What's wrong with the world?
Oh, that's a really intriguing way of looking at things.
And that led me right into my next question. You said your question that you asked them about what problem they're trying to solve stumps most of them. How do you and your company, how do you get them past that? How do you unstump them?
There you go.
So we have a set of people on our team who are not programmers, the people who actually type on the computer.
Okay.
a different set of people, and they have a great title. They are called high-tech anthropologists.
Oh my goodness.
That sounds fun.
I like that.
Can you find that title for us?
And they have business cards, and their LinkedIn profiles say Menlo High-Tech Anthropologist. And it's a cool title for sure. And a lot of people, again, look at us funny. They're like, what does anthropology have to do with software?
Right.
And a lot of people get anthropology and archaeology confused.
Right. Sure.
They're the same thing. Archaeology is about dusting off things and finding dinosaur bones and that sort of thing. An anthropologist's job is to study people. Because solve a problem, we're going to solve that problem for people. So we should understand those people. We should understand who we're trying to solve the problem for. And our anthropologists are very good. They have a whole process themselves they go through to understand, you know, what are the big problems they have in the world? These people who walked in our door, what are they imagining? Why are they imagining that thing? How did they get to the point where this new piece of software, this new device, this new technology is somehow going to help solve some real problems for real people out in the world? And we'll ask them, you know, what kind of problems are you trying to solve? And just to give you an example of the kind of
okay.
our door, because I can make this a little more practical. There is a woman, she is an entrepreneur. She has her own business. She started.
Okay, great.
And what her business does is kind of fascinating. She manages all of the dog agility contests across the United States.
Oh my gosh, we just watched one of those. Those are so amazing.
Aren't they? The dogs running up ramps, running
really
through all
fast.
The
They're like,
well, I will tell you, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners would know this for sure. Dog owners can be a little crazy about their animals.
Yes. I'm a dog owner. Yes, I agree. Yes.
I mean, if you think there's like, well, my dad's better than your dad, guaranteed every kid who has a dog, my dog is better than your dog. My dog is faster than your dog. My dog is more agile than your dog. Yes. And so, of course, these are contests.
Contests
have little people with timers. They have little people watching all the different things the dogs do.
Sure.
And then, of course, at the end, you add up all the numbers and you rank everybody. And then some dog gets the equivalent of a trophy cup or a blue ribbon taped to their leash or something like that. And so all of that stuff is in a broad category of data, right? Information that needs to be recorded. And you can imagine the people who take dog agility contests very seriously. They're going to scoop their dog up every weekend and drive to some faraway city into an arena and have their dog compete. And somebody has to keep track of how all these dogs did. So they can report the results and they can keep track of, like, you know, basically, who's the best dog in the world?
Sure. Like the best golfer, right?
Who's the world champion dog? Well, it's little Ginger, the Chihuahua that can run, you know, through all these gates and everything. She's really fast and she's really nimble and really smart. And so that's the kind of people who come to us and they want us to build the software that runs on the computer that allows the woman who runs the programs for these dog agility contests to reliably, and this is really important, computers can be a little famous for losing data if you
been there. Yeah. I've lost a manuscript or two, or at least thought I did, which is pure panic, right?
Absolutely. Like, and you can imagine if we lose track of all the data of all the wonderful dogs that have competed for all these years, that's really important. So it's not just the fact that we can build software. We need to build software that works. We need to build a software that's reliable. Just like when we build a building, we don't want the building to fall down. When we build a bridge, we want the bridge to fall down. We don't want the software to lose the data. And so there's part of it that's about the design part, understanding the people and how they're going to use it and what they want out of it. And then there's the building part, which is how do we do this in a way that makes it reliable and will work day in and day out every single day?
Well, I love that way. And so I'm thinking if you kind of preempt and ask these questions up front, then maybe when you come to the coding, it's a lot easier and not so much, that is not what I wanted, right?
Oh, yeah. And my you know, the software industry is famous for building things that nobody needs. Okay. And, you know, Jeff used the word joy in my introduction because I read books on joy. And we want to bring joy to software.
Yes.
Again, it's probably that sentence where you're like, I never heard anybody use those two words.
Exactly.
I was telling the truth in the introduction. And I love that you have put those two together. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. Well, so here's the thing. Software's hard. You know, any of your listeners who've actually tried to make something on a computer, both the strength of the computer and the frustration of the computer is the computer does exactly what you tell it to do.
Yes. Great way to put that.
It doesn't really care if you told it wrong. It's like, I'm going to keep doing this wrong over and over and over. Because it doesn't have feelings about rightness or wrongness. It just says, you gave me these instructions and I'm going to execute them exactly the way you told it, because they're assuming the human was smart enough to tell it to do the right thing.
Correct. Sure.
And so for us, we took a different approach. We wanted to make sure, let me say it very clearly, there is only one thing that thrills a team like ours, that brings us joy, and that is to see our work get completed, that we feel proud about what we did.
Right.
Able to deliver it to the world so people use it day in and day out. And they come back and they find us later and they look at us and they say, I got to tell you, you guys did a great job. I love this software.
Oh, that is fantastic. I think that's good for anything, right? I mean, that's how I feel when people come up and tell me, I love your book. And it just kind of hits you right there in the heart. You're just like, oh, this is why I go through all of that to do what I do.
And let me encourage your listeners on this front that software, like writing a book or learning how to draw or paint, which I never learned to do very well, but I always admire people who do, software is art history. Software is an artist's journey. And so it is artistic to design and develop software. This is a form of art. Now, it's a different kind of form of art than writing a book or drawing a picture or drawing a book, but it requires the same kind of imagination and innovation and creativity that's required to do anything else. But there's also a very practical aspect to software, right? Let's say that your students want to design a game. And they have this really great idea and they work hard on it. They work through the night. They work through the weekends. They spend months and months. And then they deliver that game to the world and nobody uses it. Everybody's like, oh, I don't like that game. Or it doesn't work right. Right? That's crushing.
Yes.
I want people to say, no, I love, give me more. Tell my friends. I want everybody.
Yes.
Exactly. Right?
And so that's what we've created here at my company, is this idea that there is a way of doing things that can produce those kind of results. And again, when we do, that is joy for us.
That's awesome.
Our work get out in the world, delight the people who use it every day.
That's fantastic. And I have to tell you, I think this is the first time since I've been with this show, you stole the words right out of my mouth, because my next question for you was going to be, even though I'm sure your office is filled with computer programmers and software engineers, which are on the science side of the arts and sciences balance, it sounds like the way you begin and attack each software problem for your customers that are coming in, it sounds like you are approaching each one like an artist, asking those questions and trying to get the answers and the purpose before you put the sciencey work of building it in.
Jeff, I want to say that if there are any, I'm guessing, Jeff and Jennifer, you have teachers who also listen to this podcast.
Yes.
Every teacher group I've ever been in front of, and I have been in front of a lot of them, often give me either just a really strong clap or maybe even a standing ovation when I say what I'm about to say. Science, technology, engineering, math, important. Absolutely important. You cannot create great software without the arts. Yes. It is possible.
Excellent. Excellent way to put that.
And if we have medicine arts, we will have very boring, uninteresting technology.
Well, and I mean, also with the same thing for technology and science. I mean, part of science is observation. And how many scientists have we had on the show, Jeff, that talk about either taking photographs? We've had photographers on here, but also draw images and learn from all of the different aspects of looking at images or fossils and studying them and observing. That's all artists, you know, that uses that part of your brain.
And let me tell you one other fun project we're working on, just because.
Ooh, sure.
You know, it intrigues the imagination, intrigues my imagination. Ooh. In 2025, NASA is going to launch a satellite, and they're going to put it out at this point between the Earth and the sun. It's called the Lagrange point. So yep. I'm going to ask your students at the end to figure out what a Lagrange point is, because it's
really there you
excellent.
Go.
But that satellite's going to go out at the Lagrange point. It's going to stay there between the Earth and the sun. And as the Earth goes around the sun, that satellite's going to track around with it because of that special gravitational field in the Lagrange point. And that satellite is going to be collecting data for all the solar stuff that's coming off of the sun and the way the sun interacts with what's called the interstellar medium. There's another homework assignment. The solar system interacts with what's outside the solar system. And our team is designing the software that will allow the scientists for decades to come to ask those questions of curiosity. What do I want to learn about the sun today? And the software my team is building are going to allow the scientists to answer those questions.
As Galactic Space Geek Jeff for the show, that is fantastic. I know about that probe.
Yes.
I do know about the Lagrange points, and I love that you're going to ask that later. But I've never thought about a spacecraft in terms of its software as much as I am at this very moment.
Right.
And my brain is, I'm not even part of the process. I'm just going to teach about it once it gets launched. My brain is already sparking questions by the dozen of, okay, what are we going to study? What can scientists pull? What kind of information is your software going to bring in?
Well, you know, one of the greatest questions that can always be asked in terms of science at any point in time is, what are we going to learn that we don't already know?
Yes. Yes. Or, and some of those things, because we just did a different show and we've had this on some other shows, what will we learn that might disprove what we thought we already knew?
What are we going to learn that proves that the thing we knew was absolutely true is no longer true?
I know, right? So my question is, go ahead.
And that's exciting, right? I mean, it's fun.
Oh, it's so exciting.
You know, and let me tell you, my team is so excited to be working on a project because we are actually going to get invited in February of 2025 when that satellite gets up. We're going to be invited down to Florida to be there for the launch of the satellite.
Oh, that is amazing.
Wonderful. What a connection and what a way, especially for your team. Talk about adding joy to the process.
Yes. Absolutely. And, you know, I have a dream, personal dream that I've been pursuing since I was the same age as most of your listeners. I want to build the software one day for the Starship Enterprise.
Oh,
wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're talking to two Trekkies here.
Two Trekkie geeks.
Yes.
You know, my software's on that ship. I mean, you know, all the voice recognition, all the stuff that ship has to have. There's going to be a ton of software, and this is my entry point. We are now working with NASA, and you know, the sky isn't even the limit anymore.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's not.
I work at a space museum in Colorado. As soon as you start working on that project, all you got to do is say the word, I quit, and I'm moving to wherever you are.
You know, I'm in. We're going to be in space, Jeff.
Let's go.
We'll be in space. That sounds fun. So when you have a client like NASA, which I don't know if you've worked with NASA before, does that mean like everybody gets to learn all about the science too as it's going through, right?
Yeah, it's really fun. The project manager, Emily, on our side, our project manager, has worked at Menlo for the last 12 years, and she has a PhD in astronomy. This is the first time she's actually gotten to apply what she learned in school. And she's geeked out about
this. Oh,
That's great. That is terrific. Thank you so much for sharing that particular project with us. Wow, what a connection. I want to bring it back to the software and our listeners. You know, software is kind of that, I feel like it's one of those topics where there are people that use devices and there are people that know how to make devices work. And is that line, does that line have to be so black and white? Or for those of us that just like to open our laptop and have it work or touch our phone and have it work, is software really that much of a foreign language? Or could we understand it a little more?
You know, it's like everything else. You know, we, for example, you know, all of your listeners have grown up with these devices in their hands. They probably knew how to use them when they were kids, right? I watch my, here's a good one. The first words out of my now 2-year-old granddaughter's mouth.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Google. Not mama, not dad.
Hey, Google, where's my mama?
Nana. Hey, Google. That's what she
learned. Oh, my.
And of course, Google. You know, here's the interesting thing, right? She is actually programming a computer when she does that.
Yes.
Giving it a voice command, you know, go play this song or, you know, tell me what the temperature is and that sort of thing. Now, there is a lower level of programming that's going on that's teaching that little device
how
to listen, how to hear, how to interpret what's being said. Those are not trivial problems to
teach a
computer how to listen and understand what it's hearing. And then, of course, go out and figure out what the answer is to whatever's being asked and then present the answer back again. So, you know, Jeff, to your question, I'm going to just encourage all of your listeners. They should understand enough about programming to at least, like many things in life, have a respect for the people who do it well.
Oh, yes.
I like that.
I do. I'm one of those people that when I get a new device or whatever, I'm just, because I just want to open it up and it works. And my husband has to remind me, you have to set this thing up, right? With all the way you want it. And you have to log in and you have, like, you can't just open it up and boom. It's like, I know I'm Jen's laptop and this is how I'm supposed to perform. He's like, no, that's not how it works. And I think a lot of people maybe don't realize that. I mean, I definitely appreciate software programmers, but probably, I don't know. I don't know if I could do that because don't you kind of have to anticipate what you think people will want to do when you build the software?
Absolutely. But you know what? Kids are better at it than we are.
Well, that's true.
Right. Yeah. Imagine like, well, what if they do this? What if they do that? What if it goes like this? What if they choose that? Right. And that's just fun. I mean, that's the fun part of programming is trying to guess ahead and say, how are people going to use this? What should it do when they do X, Y, or Z? All that sort of thing. And, you know, and kids today who are getting the little electronic computers, the low expensive computers, the Arduinos and that sort of thing, and they can start making it turn lights on or cause a little robot to crawl across a table or something. And I will tell you, the most fun I had as a kid, because I started touching computers when I was about 13 years old. So I'm way older than your listeners are now. Computers, but this was way back in 1971, which sounds like a millennium ago to your listeners. But here's the part I enjoyed the most. At a certain point, I got good at enough that I would bring my parents and say, hey, mom and dad, watch what the computer's going to do. And then I'd show them something, they'd be like, wow, how does it do that? And I'm like, I did it. They look at you like, you know how to do that? You know how to tell the computer? Yeah, my father-in-law, who's 90 now, when I told him what I did for a living, he's like, well, what is software exactly? And you're trying to describe it like the soul of the machine or something like that. And I said, well, dad, you know, what we really do is we tell the computer what to do. And he says, what? No, the computer tells me what to do.
Yes. So
this
conversation is going to take a while, right? I mean, you know, Jennifer, to your point, when you finally get your phone working.
Yes.
And it works well and it does what you want it to do. There is a marvelous set of software that's going on behind the scenes that just works. And it works every single day. Well, there are lots and lots of people who made that work, because without the software, you'd just be looking at a blank dark screen.
I agree. And I'm very appreciative for all of them, by the way.
As am I.
So as we are talking about all of those people, and you've shared some incredible stories about this, I know you've written two books. Both of them have joy in the title. How did you come about? Because obviously there's companies all over the world, and not all of them are using that word. How did you come about bringing joy to the workplace and to what you do?
You know, there was a part in my career, my job, where I was not joyful, where I was unhappy doing the work I was doing. And I was determined to find a new and better way of doing things than everybody else was doing, because it was important to me. Because what I wanted more than anything else was that delight that when you do something creative, like we were talking about earlier, you get it done and you hand it to somebody and they're like, I love this thing. You know, they want to look at you like, how'd you think of this? You're so lucky you get to do this for a living. This is so cool. When I thought about that, when I thought of the service to others that an engineering occupation is, because ultimately what any engineer does is they create something that helps other people. Whether it's a car, or a building, or a water system, whatever it is that those engineers are building, they're doing it to help others. And when those people you help love what it is you do, there is joy in that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's wonderful.
It is. Okay. So we could talk about joy for forever, but we are at the time of the show where we ask for the challenge. So do you have a challenge for our listeners, Rich?
So my challenge is, I'm going to challenge your listeners to go figure out why Lagrange points are so important to satellites. So I'll spell it so people know how to find it on
Google. Great. Thank you.
Yes.
L-A-G-R-A-N-G-E. Pronounced Lagrange, but, you know, the Midwesterners might say Lagrange or something. You know, it's a Lagrange. And I just want your listeners to think about, why was discovering Lagrange points so important? And I'll bet the type of people who listen to this, the type of kids that listen to your broadcast, love, absolutely love what's going on with the new James Webb telescope.
And do Jeff and I.
Yeah, of course. And you know, and the Hubble showed us some things that are so cool. And our James Webb telescope is going to be way beyond that. We're all going to be blown away when those images start coming back. And that satellite, if it's doing its job, that telescope is going to work for the next 20 years.
At least.
And here's the intriguing question. How does it do that? How does it stay where it is for that long if it doesn't have a lot of fuel on there? And you're going to find out that there are five Lagrange points between the Earth and the sun.
Yes.
James Webb is in one of them. And the satellite we're talking about that my team is working on is in a different one. So I'm going to just ask your listeners, figure out why Lagrange points are important, and also ask the question, why did they choose the Lagrange point they did for the James Webb telescope? Because that's important too.
Good addition. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. And we will be excitingly watching when you go to have the satellite launch.
February 2025.
Yeah. In fact, maybe John and I will go down there because we're not that far. So that would be amazing. Well, thank you so much. This has been really wonderful. Thank you for being on Solve for Kids, Rich.
You have brought a lot of joy to the Solve It for Kids podcast today.
Yes.
Thank you.
You bet. Great to be with you both.
Wow. I have never heard anyone talk about software and joy like that. And to be able to meld those two worlds, the way it sounds like Rich and his entire company, Menlo Innovations, has done, is fascinating.
Oh, it was so cool listening to all of that. And I'm with you. Like, software to me is just, you know, you turn on your computer and it works. But who knew that there was all of this amazing problem solving that went into it, And they're working with NASA on the new solar probe? That's just amazing. Right, Jeff? Just so
obviously,
cool.
My ears perked up as soon as I heard that Menlo Innovations was writing software for one of NASA's probes. But his challenge is absolutely spot on. Rich really hit it on the head right here. This is a lesson that is so timely with the James Webb Space Telescope being stationed at one of the Lagrange points around the Earth and the Sun, that the challenge of going to find out what those 5 points are and what makes them special is perfectly timely. Well done, Rich.
Yes, yes. And we know the answer, but we want to know if you know the answer. So if you know the answer or you find out something really interesting that you didn't know, be sure to share it with us. You can tag us on our social media, which is @KidsSolve at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget to go and check out our website, solveitforkids.com. We have an episode page for every single episode out there, including this one. And we will have some really cool information on it.
Until you look up those Lagrange points and what they mean, don't listen to the next episode yet. But until then, Jennifer and I will be staying nice and safe in one Earth gravity here on Earth's surface. And we will not be going out to a Lagrange point. But we will hear you next time on Solve It for Kids.
Solve It for Kids.